Okay. Hi, Paul. How are you doing?
I'm well this morning. And how are you doing on this fine afternoon in Ontario?
I'm doing all right. It's been a busy day. We had a bit of a difficult time in the morning with the toddler. First, he didn't want to leave the house with me. And then when we were out and had to come back, he didn't want to come back. So, you know, it's always fun when you have a two-year-old.
Well, I think Gen Squeeze attracts a lot of parents as listeners and followers, so I suspect there are some nodding heads out there empathizing with you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway, so today we are recording a discussion about some of the responses that have come in to our housing surtax proposal. Some of them have been very supportive, but as you can imagine, some have not been very supportive. And unfortunately, we're not going to be able to cover the full range of the responses because there's just so many. So I've kind of chosen a few key things, and then I'll try and summarize some of them.
Sure, yeah.
But let's just get started here. I'll start with one that is of a person who doesn't support the proposal. They say, quote, "I've been a supporter of Gen Squeeze for quite a while now, as I have daughters who are in their 30s. However, I think you need to adjust your threshold for this tax in tune with the market. If not, I cannot support the proposal. Our house is appraised at $1.1 million, but it is only a modest home, et cetera, et cetera. There's a fair bit of other things. We cannot afford to pay more taxes on this house. I'm retired. My husband will be retired soon. We have minimal RRSPs, et cetera. I fear we won't be long able to live in this house if there are more taxes that are applied." So, Paul, what do you think? So this is someone who's a supporter of Gen Squeeze in general, but doesn't support the tax.
Well, first off, don't you just appreciate the lovely way in which the person communicated, wasn't ranting, wasn't like, you know, completely angry, was wanting to engage in a thoughtful discussion about whether or not we had the right threshold. So my first reaction is like, oh, they support the concept generally, the idea that we might want to add some progressivity to our property taxation so that those in more valuable houses might contribute. And she's raising the question, have we selected the right search tax level at $1 million? I think we're going to have to agree to disagree that the $1 million isn't the right threshold. But notice that a $1.1 million home, we're asking that person to contribute an extra $200 a year. Extra $200 a year. And the way that we designed the proposal specifically for this couple in mind, they're suggesting that they're income constrained, even though they're relatively house value affluent, even if they're saying, but it's not that big a place. It's not a castle. We know many $1 million homes in Toronto and Vancouver aren't castles, but still a decent amount of housing wealth compared to many, many people. Don't forget, only about 10% of Canadians, 10 to 12% of Canadians own principal residences that are over $1 million. So if you're in that, you are in the top 10%. And so our proposal is designed so that they wouldn't have to pay that extra $200 until the home is sold or inherited, just to ensure that their constrained income situation isn't exacerbated by the implementation of this price on housing inequity.
Well, and just to follow up on that, I mean, this issue of the threshold being at $1 million, that does come up a bit. And the specific suggestion that people that I often see people making in response to our proposal is that, well, why isn't it $1.5 million when in a place like Toronto or Vancouver, you know, the average home is $1 million? So you're just targeting the average person is what the response is.
Well, first off, I would remind people that, say, take a city like Vancouver, where the majority of people are renters. So the majority of people are not owning $1 million homes. Let's just embrace that. It is inaccurate to say that the majority of homes are $1 million. And I often get people writing that across Canada, the average cost of a home is $1 million. No, the average cost of a home in home ownership is less than $700,000. So we just really need to make sure we keep some of the facts correct. And, oh, darn, I just got animated there. I think I forgot the rest of your question. Can you remind me before I get emotional? What was the next part of your question?
Why isn't the threshold $1.5 million?
Oh, so we do have a really low rate, the 0.2% on the home value from $1 to $1.5 million. And then it goes up to 0.5% from 1.5 to 2, and then a full percent above $2 million. And we do that because we're trying to send this broader signal that $1 million ought to be this kind of like psychological threshold. We don't want home prices to rise above. It's also a key way that if we capture that 1 to 1.5 million range with modest rates. Don't forget the person who had a $1.1 million, an extra $200 a year that they could defer if need be. But a number of people contributing that does help us get to that $5 billion in revenue each year that allows us to invest in deeply affordable cooperative housing and purpose-built rental. So there are a range of reasons. We want to collect revenue, but we also want to use our public policies to remind Canadians, like, we don't necessarily want home prices to rise. And so if we are, with this proposed surtax, inviting this couple and many others to say, I want to add my voice, don't let home prices rise, in part because I don't want to have to face, you know, increased taxation as my home value goes up, great. That is going to help slow down our cultural support that has for years and years and years welcomed as home prices were rising and leaving earnings behind. Don't forget, most of the time on the media, we will report that the housing market is strong or healthy as home prices rise, even if earnings do not. And that's a big part of what we're trying to disrupt. And you can see we are clearly disrupting the cultural status quo, which is part and parcel why you're observing we're getting so much feedback on this issue, including amongst people who are generally our supporters.
Okay, so then to underscore your point that it's not the average person that's being taxed with this, even in places like Toronto and Vancouver, because often when we have these discussions, we, as you pointed out, we just forget about renters.
Yeah, I have to go remind myself in Toronto, and maybe someone can send me this data, because I haven't looked at it in the last little while, whether or not like the majority of households in Toronto are also renters. I absolutely know that with certainty in Vancouver. It's just such an easy factoid for me to throw out there, and we can't lose sight of it.
And also, if the threshold were to be set at 1.5 million, then the proportion of people who it applies to goes down significantly, right?
Yeah, so let me see. There's about 12% of Canadians who own principal residences above $1 million. 7.6% of that 12%. So in other words, the majority of people over $1 million live in the million to $1.5 million range. Above 1.5 million, you have 4.5. You only have 4.5% of the population. So we are trying to grab the attention of a broad enough part of the population to have this policy touch people and help change expectations for what will happen in the housing system.
Okay, so now I'm going to read out someone who's supportive, an email from someone who's supportive of the proposal. They write that, quote, "We live in a modest townhouse in North Vancouver, which means that the valuation is over $1 million. I read that sentence and I thought, oh, okay, maybe they're not going to support this. But in fact, the next sentence is, I wholeheartedly agree with the surtax proposal as we need to find solutions for so many people not being able to attain a safe home. Housing is an essential fundamental human right, and our governments have done a catastrophic job of ensuring affordable housing. There are small steps being taken that, frankly, are not moving the needle. I don't believe the surtax will resolve the housing crisis either, but at least it will hopefully assist those most in need. And last but not least, hugely inflated property prices are a drag on the Canadian economy to the detriment of all. Thanks for the great work you do. I am a big fan."
Oh, well, that does make my heart go pitter-patter. And amongst a sea sometimes of, you know, angry emails, it's so lovely to get the support of one as well. And so let's have that person join me and others in a, you know, a group of people living in million-dollar-plus homes calling for the surtax or calling for added taxation of property value about $1 million. So we can do a range of things, including investing in deeply affordable housing, but also potentially reduce the income taxes on middle earners who are renters and so forth. So this, it's a great thing. I also think the last line is so critical. This is somebody who's really getting it. Our approach to economic growth, which has relied so heavily on real estate rental and leasing, it's the biggest part of the BC economy, it's the biggest part of the Ontario economy, it's the biggest part of the Canadian economy, and it produces so little employment directly. And so it's creating this pattern of growing our major cost of living, but not growing the incomes of people generally in the community. So that's increasing unaffordability, and it's one way to grow our gross domestic product, but it's not a great way to grow an economy where work pays off more. And that's ultimately what we want. We want hard work to be able to more easily cover our major costs of living and to do so in sustainable ways. Our housing system is neither sustainable nor celebrating hard work paying off.
Yeah. So within and among our supporters are people who own homes worth over $1 million. And that's an important part of the constituency that needs to be part of this push to win this surtax.
Can I remind people about some of the polling data that we got? This was, I think, the most fascinating part, where it showed that some of the highest rates of support for adding a surtax on the top 10% of households in terms of the value of the principal residence they own is among people who live in million-dollar homes. So that's the group that understands in particular that this is a signal of affluence. When you then say, oh, but notice that the top 10% is at that million-dollar threshold level, that's when we start to have them like, oh, I didn't know you meant me. Now, not everyone. There's still, you know, a chunk of people, and we just got a letter from one of them suggesting as much. But that is a place where we are wanting to have a conversation with those in million-dollar homes, which might have been bought by a waitress or bus driver or whatnot some decades ago for much, much less money. And they've never thought of themselves as affluent. And we're in this conversation right now as we're disrupting the status quo to say what truly constitutes affluence. It's not just the income we earn. It's actually access to stable, secure housing and home equity in that housing. And the fact that there's such an age pattern and stratification to that is really disrupting what had been more typical class dynamics a couple of decades ago. And so it's not surprising some people have, I'm not wealthy, but as we release more and more of our polling data going forward, I think it's going to be really interesting for people to see how Canadians' attitudes recognize that housing is so disruptive for our past understanding of what made someone affluent or not.
Yeah, but if only all the people who are wealthy were supportive of this proposal, that would be nice, wouldn't it? Unfortunately, that's not the case. And so the next email is from one such person who I assume is quite wealthy. He happens to be a Vancouver-based realtor.
Oh, interesting.
And he has a very, very short email that he wrote in response to our proposal. He said, "Unfortunately, socialism in class warfare is not the solution. If you and your leader had ever had to work for a living in the real world, you'd know this." And I'm assuming he's quite well-to-do because he claims that in his signature that he has won the Real Estate Board of Greater Vancouver's medallion. I guess that's some sort of a prize. Since 2007, he's top 2% of realtors in the Greater Vancouver area. And there's a few other things in there in terms of awards and things. Yeah, so this person is rich. They don't like us.
It's not that they don't like... I mean, there's just so many funny... actually vexing things about that email. So I'm going to take offense at the idea that I don't work. I can't believe someone would say as much. So full stop, I work 50 plus hours per week, people. I work at a university. I work to create this not-for-profit called Generation Squeeze. You know what? Technically, I think I'm even a job creator because we actually have run a not-for-profit that then provides the livings for multiple people who are working with us. So it is so vexing to hear that kind of thing. It's just rude, and it cheapens the level of democratic dialogue in this country. Not to mention that the moment some uninformed realtor talks about taxation as implying it is the signal of socialism, it just reveals how intellectually bereft this individual is. Every capitalist country on the planet has taxation. The question is, how do we organize it to make the taxation as efficient and fair as possible for the goals we wish to achieve? And there are countless and countless research articles that show that the homeownership tax shelter that we've created in Canada is not only remarkably unfair, it is inefficient for the economy in terms of directing our investments in the private sector into what will create the greatest productivity, the greatest innovation, and the improvements to wages. So I invite this guy, you know what? Don't degrade the level of democratic debate in this country if you're going to be that frigging ignorant. And yeah, you work in an industry where in BC, it's 20% of GDP and fewer than 2% of people are making their living in that industry. No wonder you're happy with the status quo, because you make a whole bunch of wealth windfalls as you contribute to an industry that has sat by happily as hard work pays less off for everyone else who doesn't work in your industry. So realtors out there, send me an email saying, yeah, I understand that the way in which real estate is part of our provincial economy or national economy needs to be revisited. There's got to be some of you out there, because if not, then you are missing the forest for the trees and for all your neighbors and family members who are also not realtors.
I don't really know what realtors do. So I mean, I think this person needs to get a real job. And then
you mean you're going to put back? What was his line?
If you and your leader had ever had to work for a living in the real world, like as if being a realtor is living in the real world.
Well, I want to be careful. We don't want to demean the hard work that people do. And I imagine there are many, many realtors out there who provide an important service for people as they're sometimes making the biggest purchase or sale of their lives. And you need to have someone that you can trust to help you do that work. So let us not demean, let us not play this individual's game. Let's honor hard work when it is there. And let us shoot down ignorant contributions to democratic debate. Disagree with the details of the proposal and bring to us evidence about why you think that's the disagreement is worthwhile. That's great. And no one is suggesting, just as that last more clever, lovely woman said, we're not suggesting this surtax is the panacea, the silver bullet. We know it's one policy tool amongst many. It's why we have a much more comprehensive plan to restore housing affordability. And we can talk about the details. But as Jen Squeeze is in the business of rejuvenating democracy to try and fix this broken intergenerational system, that kind of discourse shared with us in the email does us a disservice. So we're gonna go high as they go low. I'm not quite sure who said that. Maybe that's Michelle Obama.
I know I shouldn't. All right. So yeah, next rather than reading out an email, I'm gonna sort of summarize a few different ones that we've gotten that have been supportive, and I'll include a couple things. So often we get supportive people who say, this is great, but the tax you're proposing should be higher.
Yes.
And then another thing we'll get is people saying, yes, this is great. And we should also be doing things like taxing homeowners more who have multiple investment properties.
Yep. Pardon me. So thanks for all of those positive comments. And to some degree, they are in the same vein of the woman that you were sharing from earlier, where they were lending support but questioning the threshold. In this case, people are lending support and saying, oh, but the rate's not high enough. And so I want to draw the attention, like people conceptually, there's actually a great deal of interest in this. And I've already signaled from our polling data that 2/3 or so of Canadians are supportive of this idea of having the surtax on the home over $1 million. Let's not lose sight of that as we're talking about some of the negative responses that we're getting. And so, yeah, I love it when people say that we're not actually bold enough with our rates. If that's the kind of critique that we're sometimes going to get, that actually is helpful, because when you're trying to disrupt the cultural status quo, when you have some people say you're being, you know, you're not being bold enough, and you have other people critiquing you, if we're somewhere in the middle there, there can be some safe political ground with which to encourage politicians to say, hey, there's enough cover here for you to respond courageously to the evidence saying we need to disrupt the status quo. That's one thing I would observe. Second of all, again, remember, we don't suggest this surtax on home value above $1 million, this price on housing inequity, is intended to be the silver bullet. It's one of many. And so I want to take my hat off to Better Dwellings, which is this really great group that provides daily commentary about the data around Canada's housing system. It's such a great public service. If you haven't seen Better Dwelling, go check them out. And they have done a really good job in particular drawing our national attention to the proportion of Canadians, residents who own multiple homes. I think last I looked, it was like 1 in 6, something like that. A really high number of Canadians own multiple homes. And so we could think about how we might want to discourage that approach to treating housing as an investment strategy as opposed to a place to call home. Now, it's complicated because when those people are buying these homes and if they're renting them out, some people are going to say, but that's, you know, really important rental stock that we need. And so really, do we want to discourage that? Generally, I would say we want to incentivize having more and more purpose-built rental, and we can have a different conversation with that. But the short story is purpose-built rental gives renters more security of tenure than does the more small-scale landlord who has bought one or two or three extra homes, and then their approach to keeping that asset is more about what's their life cycle goals. When's the asset reaching a value for them that they wish to then, you know, sell off, as opposed to purpose-built rental is a business model built around people being there for decades and decades.
Well, and I guess it's something else to highlight the fact that, you know, home ownership to begin with allows you to engage in more home ownership. So if you get into the door, then you can borrow on the rising equity of your home to then invest into buying more homes.
Well, this actually then brings us back to that concept of the bank of mom and dad that people might have seen. I've done a Hard Truth video about not that long ago, and you haven't. I'd send you to the bank of mom and dad, which is a phrase that I just really detest. Because one of the things that home ownership has allowed an older demographic to do over the last years, they built up equity in their home. Then they see actually sometimes that their kids are being locked out of the possibility of home ownership. And so then they do this beautifully generous thing within the family and say, oh, we'll use some of our equity to get a home for you, which kind of, it does help sort of solve a bit of the problem within that family. But two things unfold that make me worried. One, it reinforces this sort of infantilization of the younger adult and saying, oh, you know, you couldn't actually make a secure home if you didn't have the, you know, support and care from your older parents. And so it gives rise to this sense, oh, these lazy younger adults today, they can't make it on their own without having to rely longer than anyone would have ever reasonably expected on their parents, as opposed to recognizing the parents' equity is rising in no small part because the housing system is demanding more and more hard work from younger people to get into the housing system. They have to save more, they have to borrow more, they have to bid more on housing. And as that's then influencing rent, they're having to pay more for rent as they're waiting to try and get into homeownership. Both of those things are actually building up the equity of the bank of mom and dad, which then allows them to get multiple homes. And interestingly, it's probably building those second and third homes that they might be helping their kids with. It's actually often building the equity of their parents, not the young adults. So this is a complex dynamics. And I love the sentiment, the intergenerational solidarity within the family where the bank of mom and dad is coming into play is a lovely sentiment. And you've heard me with Angie saying in other moments, we want more of that solidarity brought to the world of politics. But it is the case that whether you're doing it for your kids or you're buying multiple homes for other reasons, it's been enabled by this dramatic rise in home prices over the last decades that's built up equity for homeowners. And we say, oh, then I can go and do that in other units as well. And as a result, you get groups like Better Dwelling drawing our attention to the data showing that a large proportion of everyday Canadian homeowners own multiple homes. And if I recall, I think it's a majority of the federal cabinet.
Wow, that's concerning.
I'm not sure if it's the majority. We need to fact check that one, but it was a large proportion. Definitely on the fact check on that one. Anyone want to send an email? I'd love that. I'm sure that's been quoted to me in previous interviews, but it's just not in my head.
Okay, so the next email I'm going to read is also from someone who doesn't support the proposal. This is a good one. this person is addressing this directly to you, Paul. He refers to you as Doctor.
Oh, nice. Thank you.
It says, Doctor, I wish to address your article in Maclean's. Is it my fault my home has reached the value of $1 million? We did not do anything to create its value. The market for housing did. My wife and I are just short of our 80th birthdays. We worked fully up until retirement, never collected a penny in social assistance, and paid and continue to pay taxes. We are not rich. Our home is the main reason we can live in retirement comfortably. Now, and now is in all caps, now you are suggesting that we be penalized again for daring to live in something other than a shack on a dead-end road with no running water or electricity. Thanks. What tax will you think of next to penalize us for? Why not go after the incompetent federal government with their tax department in bed with the rich who hide money offshore and are in bed with big business?
Wow, that is, I mean, there's just so many parts of that email. Let's start with this notion of penalizing someone. I'm a little bit discouraged to hear someone who, I think he said he self-identified in his 80s, describing the payment of taxes as a penalty. And I applaud this person. I've worked hard. I've been able to be personally responsible. I've been independent. So I, you know, kind of like a net contributor. I think he's saying, why are you wanting more from me now? And I think that there's Three things. I would remind anyone who is a retiree right now that if they're claiming old age security, which I suspect this person is, they're actually doing so at a moment where they didn't prepay for all of the benefits they're trying to claim right now. Indeed, the bills for old age security for our aging population are falling to their kids and grandchildren. So, you know, you might ask the person to contribute more based on their housing wealth to address that intergenerational tension. Second of all, no one's saying that this particular individual individually caused the home prices to rise, but they've definitely been a beneficiary. Indeed, I think by his own story is saying, I'm able to live comfortably right now. Not because I made a great product or that I made a great investment in the stock market, but because I bought a home. Now, if he's saying I bought this home because I expected it to be a really good investment return and that's how I was going to make my security in retirement, well, that's the very dynamic that we are trying to disrupt. Full disclosure, yes, I would prefer in the future, and we need Gen Squeezers to do this more and more. So that's, you know, the Gen Xers, Millennials, Gen Z. Like, don't bet on housing to be your pathway for pension security, because that will just make it worse for your kids and grandchildren for their affordability. The payoff from housing as an investment, by definition, erodes affordability. So I want to take on that issue that, dear sir, what is giving you the comfort you're describing is coming with some harms for others, and we are asking, might you be able to make a modest contribution to help address some of those harms and to slow down the economic momentum for home prices rising and leaving earnings behind? And then just that last line, like, now we won't be satisfied until this couple is living in a shack with no running water or electricity.
On a dead-end road, no less.
On a dead-end road, no less. Like, they don't like cul-de-sacs? I guess, but they don't want kids playing road hockey or something in front of their house? I can't quite tell the dead-end road part. This is akin to the real estate agent. We actually just need to call BS. We need to say, no, we will not tolerate that level of hyperbole to cheapen the quality of democratic discourse we need at this moment in order to solve big intergenerational problems like an unaffordable housing system that's creating tremendous housing wealth inequality, like a climate policy system that is not requiring people to pay enough for their pollution and just literally putting at risk the determinants of health for younger and future generations. We can't tolerate that. And so don't give us this extreme example that no one is actually talking about. We want this couple to have a happy, healthy life. And we have said, if this surtax is actually going to constrain your income at this particular moment, we've designed the deferability option so that you don't have to incur the additional taxation until the home is sold. It's just so that you can stay in your home. So, dear sir, don't degrade the conversation and give us silliness, because I want you to be healthy. I want you to be happy. I want you to contribute your fair share. I want you to be part of the solution. If you don't want that, then go join some other discourse that's not very Canadian and getting the best out of our country.
Well, I do think, you know, this kind of response, you know, there is something that's correct in here, right? Like, we didn't do anything to create the value or to raise the value of the home. And that should be a clue as to maybe why, you know, it's not fair that then this wealth isn't taxed, because, like, we're taxed on plenty of things that we do work for, right? I gain an income and I get taxed on that. So why shouldn't someone who's just been sitting in their home and it's been accruing equity not get taxed on that?
Oh, that's a better answer than I gave him, Mayor. So this concept of windfall is actually especially why we're saying it would be more efficient for our taxation to go after capturing some of the windfall profits that people have made, not from hard work, not from creating a new product, not from creating jobs for a range of people, just to some degree from the lottery of timing of having bought a home in a housing system that's become dysfunctional. But let's give credit to this individual on one important thing. I think he points to a nuance that Gen Squeeze would do better to attend to, especially as we're trying to attract an older demographic to lean in on any of a range of issues. And that is, can we distinguish between the actions of individuals operating a system where the individuals likely operated in good faith? And distinguish that from the broader political culture of which they were a part, but not directly responsible for, but that broader political culture has tolerated a dysfunctional system. And so I think that's what we need to do right now, especially with our aging loved ones who we want to have them lead in as we're trying to make sure they leave a proud legacy for those who follow in their footsteps. I do think many, many of our parents and grandfathers acted in good faith in a system that has turned out to be dysfunctional. And in a political world where our politicians have not been fast enough in responding to the dysfunction, in part, and here's the part that we have to bring back, for those who were the stewards of the system at the time, the citizens of our country at the time, not being loud enough to call attention to the problems that we were able to predict. So I think maybe that's what this gentleman is getting at a little. And I would encourage all of us at Gen Squeeze to try and figure out how do we frame our communications so that we can acknowledge the good faith with which individuals acted in a system that now we're hoping they'll see has been problematic. And how can they then contribute to the solution to the problem at this moment, especially for those on whose watch it happened. And I'll bring people back to the very first episode of this podcast where with Angie, we were chatting about what is intergenerational fairness. And we talked about being a good steward, fostering generational reciprocity, and planning for all ages. And being a good steward is like making sure that you protect things that are sacred, like access to a good home and a healthy childhood and a stable climate. And the aging population has not protected some of those things.
Yeah. And in thinking about the response we've been getting, or some of the critical response we've been getting, I've been thinking about this quote that's often misattributed to Gandhi, and I'm quite certain it's misattributed. A lot of things are misattributed to him, but nonetheless, it's interesting. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win. So the real world doesn't necessarily work like that, but let's use that as our model. If we're on step three, where there are plenty of people willing to fight us, then the next step is that we're right around the corner to winning.
Well, that is a hopeful way to begin a week. Let's just end there. Sign off. I like it.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Gen Squeeze's Hard Truths podcast. If you've got thoughts about what you heard, let us know by writing to info@gensqueeze.ca. Also, please consider rating and reviewing the podcast. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll see you again soon.